University of Pittsburgh. I can't remember the last time that I was here. I guess I've lectured at more than 2,000 colleges throughout the United States of America since the year 1967. I spoke at Bucknell University on the 27th. I was supposed to speak at another college over here, but the storm washed us out on Tuesday, so we're here. It looked like I'm not going to get back to Philadelphia for another day or two, because we have to get all across country. And to me, it's really, I feel good to be alive, still kicking. I did have a heart attack a 2 years ago, but they say I got longevity. I bounced back, you know. let me try to rap to you about some of the 1960s protest movement history with respect to the Black Panther Party, how it evolved and why it evolved. There's a piece of American history catalyzed out of the African-American community. But I was a young man back then as an engineering design major at Merritt College, community college. I only took 9 credit hours or 12 credit hours a semester, mostly 9 credit hours. And I worked a full-time job at night. Prior to this period, I put 4 years in the United States Air Force as a structural repairman of high-performance aircraft. I guess in some circles, James Baldwin and many others have told me that I was quite lucky. When we speak of growing up and evolving, I was raised a carpenter and a builder from age 6 years of age. My father built our first home from the ground up himself in Port Arthur, Texas. My grandpa built the town of Weirgate, Texas, East Texas, east of Jasper, Texas. Jasper, Texas, where Bird, the brother, was drugged to death by some racists there. The brother Bird was drugged to death is really a fourth cousin to my family. My mother and father were born in Jasper, Texas. But through Jasper, through Beaumont, Port Arthur, San Antonio, we wound up in Berkeley, California in 1945. As a young man, I came out of the United States Air Force and wound up at Merritt College Engineering Department. I was an engineering design major. And one day I was walking across the street, 2 blocks this way, across the street from Merritt College is where I live, our family home. And I saw this group of people, 30 or 40 people standing on the corner, and I heard some speakers. A wide, busy street. I crossed the street, and someone over there was speaking to these people standing around, mostly black students. The Afro-American Association has come here today to tell it like it is. I had never heard the phrase the Afro-American Association. This is in 1962, spring semester, Merritt College. I walked over with my big see-through carrying case for my drafting board and my other engineering design instruments. I saw a tall guy that I knew. I hadn't seen him since I was 16 years of age. His name was William Brumfield. This guy finished speaking, and William Brumfield spoke and got back, and I walked up to William. I said, "Hi, William, hi." He says, "Bobby Seale, long time." I says, "What is this Afro-American Association? Some kind of communist stuff or something?" He says, "Bobby Seale, of all people, to say that." I said, "What do you mean?" So pointedly, he said to me, "Who are the Sioux?" I said, "Their name is not the Sioux." I said, "You know that. The name is the Lakota. Sioux is a French word. It means cutthroat. It has nothing to do with the real cutthroat of American Indians." He says, "And we're not colored. And we're not Negroes. We have a descendancy. We descend in our history." He says, "African-American, Afro-American, that is about correct social science reference to us, et cetera, and so on." So with that, and listening to some other speakers, and then after the speakers were over, William introduced me to about 6 people in this Afro-American Association, and one of them was Huey Newton. I shook hands with him. So William, I says, "Okay." I says, "I see where you're coming from." I said, "I need to get some books to read." So he suggested that I read a book by Jomo Kenyatta called Facing Mount Kenya. I stepped to one of the bookstores, bought the book, went home, changed clothes, and went to work. And in between inspecting engine frames for the Gemini missile program, where I worked in the engineering department at Aerospace Electronics just outside of Oakland, California, I sit down at my desk and begin to read this book and discover that this man named Jomo Kenyatta was an anthropologist that came to England and also to America, got his degrees and went back. And in effect, had organized his people out from under the yoke of English colonialism in the country of Kenya. This blew my mind. I mean, I said, wait a minute. It's like a vague, kind of confusing reference to Africa based on a certain level of brainwashing that I had went through up to the age of 26, 27 when this was happening. That, wait a minute, Tarzan doesn't run Africa. I mean, movies that I was raised with. I mean, I get A's in mathematics. I get A's in architecture, design, and that. I mean, I only get C's in English, but my point is, I knew nothing about my African-American people's history, sorry, nothing, until I began to read this particular work. You know, I dispelled Tarzan quickly, because I was remembering a movie, Tarzan, this white paternalistic guy supposedly swinging on a vine or something. Supposedly he was smarter than everybody. Blacks and Africans were dumb, docile, etc. in their depiction of us. I mean, I remember seeing some dumb movies where they would go to Los Angeles black community, hire some brothers off the street to these B-movies, and have them play some African natives. Brothers got process in their head, half naked, standing up there with a spear in their hand, trying to look cool instead of looking cool. I mean, I've seen them kind of movies. But more important, I'm telling you, to read this work just blew away that whole image of this Tarzan who could speak and talk to the animals and tell a herd of elephants, oh, no, 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 and tell those elephants to go over there and kick that adversary's butt, and elephants go over there and did this crap. This whole paternalistic myth, almost deliberate so-called artistic misuse of what human history was about, that sparked me. Next thing I know, I'm reading Black Bourgeoisie by E. Franklin Frazier. I'm picking up W.B. Du Bois's Black Reconstruction. I'm picking up Dr. Herbert Aftack's documentation of 250 slave revolts from the year 1800 to 1857. I mean, a dissertative documentation of 250 slave revolts. I went to Berkeley High School. Berkeley High School was one of those high schools next door to the University of California, had been top rated, and some teacher had told me when I was 16, well, I think that the black people sort of must have liked slavery because they could sit on a stoop and play a banjo. Get out of here. Here it is, years later, I'm reading about Gabriel Prosser in 1800 who attempted to organize 5,000 black folks in a rebellion against the institution of slavery that they were being subjected to. I'm reading about Denmark Beese and Gabriel Prosser in that term. For Dr. Herbert Aftack had documented that slave revolts involved 10 or more slaves. He said there's much more revolting going on with less than 10 black folks through this period. So, wow, my mind is blown. I mean, it's like, I can't get enough. I'm on a quest now. Now in this period, now I have to know everything. I mean, I'm focusing suddenly on Africa. Martin Luther King comes to speak in Oakland, California. I'm a young student. And I said, I better go hear this guy. And he gets up in the auditorium, and I'm very, very inspired at one particular point when Martin Luther King says that we have to boycott these businesses and refuse to hire black folks, etc., and so on. And in effect, what he's saying is that Wonder Bread Company refuses to hire Negroes. He went on to talk about Kilpatrick's Bread Company and Langendorf Bread Company. He says, we want to boycott Wonder Bread Company. So consistently and so profoundly, we want to make Wonder Bread wonder where the money went. I'm 7,000 people. I'm one of the individuals with the other 7,000 people, and we hit the floor in a standing ovation because this brother was telling us to do something about the injustices in particular. And that was very, very important in terms of my first influence. My second influence was, of course, none other than Nelson Mandela in 1963 when he was being sentenced. And I got an organization called the African American Study Group that we in turn began to link up with this group called RAM, Revolutionary Action Movement. And we began to get petitions signed to end apartheid in South Africa. And we protested in front of the extended office. A lot of these countries have extended consular offices, the UN United Nations offices. And they are, we protested in front of the end apartheid, Free Nelson Mandela Center, and got the petition signed and submitted them to other African members and other nations, members of the United Nations. These are the first days of protest and study. But to realize and know that history, that was the key. Not only Black American history, but African history and the whole colonialization and the history of that colonialization gave me this new worldview that I had not had before. I was unmarried, you know, I was there and developing, and one day they killed Malcolm X, who was the third person who began to influence me after he left the Nation of Islam. This is one of the days I was quite proud of. That was me, you couldn't get me involved. I had such a problem with religions, you know what I mean? I wanted to deal in more what we call good, proven, scientific, evidentiary fact in terms of understanding the history and trying to realize what we had to do about our continued liberation struggle in these early days. They killed Malcolm. Hadn't seen my friend Hewitt for a while. I heard he had gotten a night in law school. He left Merritt College. And so a week later, I found out where Huey lived. All those years I knew Huey, I did not know where he lived. And I know him around Merritt College. I lived across the street from Merritt College. In fact, students would come to my house. But I found Huey and told him, I think we need to start another organization to kill Brother Malcolm X. Huey was skeptical that we could even do that. I had a copy of Frantz Fanon's book, The Wretched of the Earth, in my hand, highlighted in my yellow pen, lightning. Talking to Huey, no, we can do it. Huey said, well, I think we're going to even try to organize anything. Huey said, we have to. Black people got to know more about their history. You know, it's hard to organize people who don't understand the history. So I got on another quest at Merritt College. And I organized 15, 16 students, male and female, to meet at my house across the street from Merritt College. And we buckled down, did the research. I went and bought me a $35 special library card for University of California. The college I was at, Merritt College, was just 10 blocks from University of California, to be able to get into those libraries and check out materials. Now I'm saying that we designed four courses, four extensive, well-outlined syllabus for four courses, two courses in Black American Studies, two courses in African Studies. Organized 200 students. Got a handful of five or six of our white left radical friends and others who were part of the Socialist Workers' Party, and another Japanese friend, one other Chicano Mexican-American brother, and then, you know, almost a couple hundred young blacks, male and female, to have a meeting with Dean Olson to demand that we have Black American and African Studies in the curriculum in Merritt College. And of course, you know, we threatened that if you didn't do this, we was going to boycott, we was going to sit in, crawl in, wait in, and do everything we could at this college until you did this. You know, I was speaking to Dr. Kwame here, and he was explaining how in the history here of the Africana Studies Department here, in 1969, they occupied the computer room there, demanded that we get Africana Studies right here at this university here. I'm saying in this period, a lot of young black folks, particularly students and others in colleges and in other frameworks, demanded Black American studies, African history, and African American people. This is very, very important. So when Huey was telling me that that's what we had to do if we were going to organize people, I, in effect, moved to do that. And in effect, that was the year that Malcolm was killed. Malcolm was murdered in February 1965. Well, that fall semester, we got our first course in Black Studies right there at Merritt College. And in that context, I'm telling you that we need to do organizing. And I'm seeing Huey off and on because Huey's not really going to American College. Huey's in night school, law school, San Francisco Law School. Not San Francisco State University, but a law school, a sort of a private law school called San Francisco Law School. And I take the Black History Back group and change it to a group called Soul Students Advisory Council at American College. Because suddenly, because of the history we're studying, one particular work, Dr. Herbert Aflack's documentation of all the wars that Black Americans have fought here in the United States of America. I mean, to know this, me, I had already been 4 years in the United States military, 4 years in the United States Air Force at that time, you know, at least not at that specific time, but I came out at 22, but now here it was. I was a young man trying to understand why it was that we were dying. I mean, 29% of the people who were dying on the front lines in Vietnam in that particular war were African Americans. And having read the history and understood what Malcolm was saying, understood what Nelson Mandela and others were saying, why should we fight, became the question. Why should we fight in any more wars in the United States of America when this country does not recognize our Constitution, democratic civil human rights? This is where we were coming from. I was coming from. So what I did is a deal with some other organizational groups. I organized a rally at Merritt College campus in an auditorium similar to this. And we packed that auditorium. I got quite a few groups and organizations, speakers, dancers, acting, drummers, what have you, kind of bring our culture and reflect on that, etc. All about trying to educate the students at the campus that, one, we should not allow ourselves to be drafted to fight in the war in Vietnam because we fought in too many wars. In other words, the research of that history is clear here, and knowing and understanding it very clearly. You see, walking through that material, I found out, not only did Crispus Attucks die, but most people don't even know about the Hussian German soldiers that the King of England had hired and sent over here to this United States of America to rout out the early colonials who was trying to fight, supposedly, for freedom for America at the time. A Lafayette, a French advisor to George Washington, had went up into New England and suggested, but what you do is promise some of these blacks you got in slavery, said the French advisor, that they'll be free if they will help you guys fight, because y'all are ragtag and the Hussian German soldiers come over, they get ready to kick y'all's ass and they're gonna do something. And they did exactly that, promised a lot of blacks that they would be free up in Rhode Island area. And when the German Hussian soldiers did land, who in all, if you document this history, kicked the German Hussian soldiers' booty? Those blacks who had been promised their freedom. To understand the history of the Civil War, and many of you, if you have an opportunity, go read W.E.B. Du Bois' Black Reconstruction. This is a profound, dissertated documentation, a well-documented work about how blacks injected themselves into the Civil War the first 2 years before the Emancipation Proclamation that was written by Abraham Lincoln. How it caused a couple of generals to actually organize some regiments of black soldiers before the Emancipation Proclamation, this and how gallantly they fought. And the blacks, he says, over this period of time, more than 300,000 at different periods and different groups could be calculated to have come across, told the Northern Union Army, give us some guns, we'll help you fight these Confederates who got us enslaved. So I'm just saying, you have to see the complexity and the mixture of what this issue was about and how it evolved up to the point with the galleon fighting, getting back to the Pentagon, and all the other abolitionists, whites, blacks, whoever, and Frederick Douglass trying to lead that whole abolitionist group to end slavery in America, contributed to first the Emancipation Proclamation, and where it read, and this forever forth free, the narrow lines, the very next line states, all able-bodied black men will be taken into the Northern Union Army. In effect, 168,000 black men was enlisted into the Northern Union Army. 30,000 died. And Abraham Lincoln, of course, had to admit that if it had not been for the black men, we would not have won this war against the South, etc. So, talking about human involvement and contribution to what it means to end that peculiar and vicious, exploited institution of slavery here in the United States of America, after African Americans were right there at the forefront. And since then, on one level or another, have been at the forefront of constitutional, democratic, civil, human rights in this country. So that impressive history is something that really impressed me in conjunction with being inspired by Nelson Mandela, Martin Luther King, and Malcolm X. One night in April 1966, I was up at Huey P. Newton Hour up around University of California at night, and after going to a record boutique to check out some Howlin' Wolf and T-Bone Walker blues records, we're walking down the street, and Huey wants me to recite my poem called Uncle Sammy, a poem written by a young black man named Ronald Stone. Now, the poem was published in the Liberator magazine out of New York. We're talking 1966. I picked up on this poem as it related to that anti-war rally. Uncle Sammy called me Pulalusa. Now, there's a couple of cuss words in this thing, but you have to say the poem with all its force. But Huey has insisted that I recite this poem to Weasel, another one of our student friends, and my brother John Seal, he was with us. No, you don't understand. Come on, Bobby. I said, man, I'm not reciting any poem up here at night. Man, what's wrong with you, Huey? Oh, no, come on. Huey always thought I was a great communicator or something to that effect. Whatever. My point, though. He insisted, so we wound up in front of a sidewalk kind of cafe location on Telegraph Avenue, about four blocks down from Savers Gate. Savers Gate is the entrance to University of California at Berkeley. Nighttime, 9 o'clock, 7. So I stood out by the parking meter. I says, Uncle Sammy called me for a Lucifer. Well, I don't give a good eagle eye at that legal. And certainly somebody interrupts and says, hey, wait a minute. I said, what the heck? So this big, tall, bushy-headed white guy, kid, hippie or whatever, a big marijuana joint, and a chair in his hand. Wait a minute, man. It's just a chair. I'm sitting there, and these people stop me. You know, like, I was losing the vibes, you know. And he's smoking his joint. I said, okay, man, get away. You know, I'll stand on the chair. You know? I get on the chair. Uncle Sammy called me for the loose. But I don't give a good eagle eye that people took away the damn eye for the spot stick without church. Uncle Sammy, don't shut the jive, man. I'm hip to popcorn jazz changes, you know. You know damn well what I mean. You school my naive heart to sing red, white, and blue stars, the strike song, and the pledge to turn allegiance to all things blue, true, blue eyed, blonde hair, white chalk, white skin, with USA tattooed all over. When my soul trusted Uncle Sam. Loved Uncle Sam. As a kid, I died in dreams playing war. For you, Uncle Sammy? No, I don't want to hear that crap. You jammed your immaculate manhood somewhere. Puff with gonorrhea of corrupt, unreal tenures into my unbreezed, nigger ghetto black ass for my Jewish, Catholic, Islamic, Sioux, sure free public health penicillin cured me. But Uncle Sammy, if you want to stay a preacher, strong man, God, fuck your motherfucking self. I'm not sure. Now, Ron Stone wrote that poem. And I recited that poem. This crowd of people had stopped listening to me. And as soon as I did, Huey's saying, everybody saying, more. And Huey's telling me, I told you, this is good. So I said, come on, Huey. So some little guy, little white guy with a crew cut haircut, jeans and a yellow t-shirt, walks up behind me, grabs me on my arm. He says, hey, wait a minute, you're under arrest. I said, man, get your damn hands off me. What the hell are you? You're under arrest for using obscene language. You know, this is University of California. If anybody knows the history of the free speech movement at University of California, I'm saying F-U-C-K, you know? Free speech. No, that's obscene language. So I said, man, get out of here. I didn't know he was. He never showed me a badge. I thought he was some little citizen trying to make some citizens around. Copies, waving through the audience, grabbed at my jacket. I spun around, my jacket came off. Huey says, leave him alone, he's done nothing. The crowd started hollering behind Huey, leave him alone, he's done nothing. Yellow t-shirt tackles me. I mean, really, you know, You know, we like the boss, you know. A lot of young white boys, they like the rascals. This cat hit me in the stomach and knocked the wind out of me. I'm rolling up into the intersection. Huey is a uniform cop. He's in Huey boxes, you know. Huey came up. I mean, you have to imagine this young guy, Huey, who's been in the gym, been training in the gym in Oakland, California. It's like a young Sugar Ray Leonard, you know what I mean? This big 200-pound cop. If you ever looked at the artistic ability of Muhammad Ali and Sugar Ray Leonard, Huey is popping this guy, you know what I mean? Clockwise and go backwards. I mean, in history, we ran into this cop again. The cop said, I was going to kick your ass. He said, you remember what happened last time. But anyway, that night, me and Huey and Weezer got arrested. They took us to jail. And in effect, we had to go to court in October finally. And the judge gave us 1 year probation each. We could have got 1 to 10 years in prison because I had pulled my knife out and cut the other t-shirt in hand and came in hand. And Huey had literally pooped the other day. This is a 200-pound cop. If you pooped that cop, I mean, it's like, you know, a small man, 165 pounds, but Huey, he pooped on him. Me, I got my ass pooped on the ground. The yellow t-shirt got me down. Three other undercovers all joined in. If it hadn't been for my brother, Weasel, one Asian guy, and another young white hippie guy who knew these undercovers and kicked them all off of me. And I came up with my knife and I cut the yellow t-shirt in hand. But my point is, we went to jail. Judge Stacks in Oakland, California, having murdered, but it's Alameda County, in Oakland, California, gave us 1 year probation. Oh, we 1 year probation, no contest plea. I said, Huey, you got on the step. I said, meet me at the Warren Poverty Office tonight. I work for the city government at this time, Department of Human Resources, city government of Oakland, California. I said, and we've been talking about starting this new organization since Malcolm is dead. It's a year and a half now. Okay, we started the Black History Flag Group, Soul Students Advisory Council. I said, we could have been going to prison 1 to 10 years. So that night we met at the Warren Poverty Office after everybody's off. 4 blocks from my house and 4 blocks from Huey's house the other way. I opened with the keys to the joint and we wrote the 10-point program. We had no name for this organization. Number one, we want empowered to determine our own destiny, our own black communities. Number two, we want full employment for our people. Number three, we want decent housing for the shelter of human beings. Number four, we want history to talk about our true selves. Number five, we want to end the robbery and exploitation of our black people and our black communities. At the time then, number six, we wanted all black men and women to be exempt from any military service and not have to fight in the war in Vietnam. Number seven, we wanted immediate end to police brutality and murder of black people. Number eight, we wanted all black men and women who've been tried by all white jurors to be released from prison so they could have another trial because they've been tried by all white jurors. And reiterated the same thing in number eight about all black people having a right to fair trial and having jurors of their peers. Number nine and number ten, we summed it up. We wanted land, bread, housing, education, clothing, justice, and peace. Huey went upstairs because we've been talking about observing the police and the legal aid department area of this building. And I had to sit downstairs pecking out on the typewriter this whole thing. And then finally I ran into something and I went upstairs with Huey and I ran into this first two paragraphs of the Declaration of Independence. I said, Huey, read this. So we read that. I said, let's paraphrase this a bit and use this. This was the first two paragraphs of the Declaration of Independence. This is the founding documentation of the United States of America that said, when in the course of human events becomes necessary for any one people to dissolve the political bondage which have connected them with another and to assume among the powers of the earth the separate and equal station to which the laws of nature, nature's God entitled them, a decent respect to the opinions of humankind dictate that they declare the causes which impel them to dissolve that political bondage that they are subjected to. When a long train of abuses and usurpations pursues and invariably evinces a design to reduce a people under absolute despotism, then it is the right of the people to also change their government and provide new guards for their future security and happiness. We lifted that. looking at the tail end of our keyboard platform and program. It's all in this book I brought here tonight that I'm going to autograph for most of you, but I'm just saying we lifted it and put it there and still didn't have a name for this organization. I got my wife, we got Huey's brother, Melvin Newton, that just started graduate work at the University of California. We got him to come over to look at our Chipboard platform and program, and we refined it a bit more. I got my wife, my first wife, to come down to the Warren Poverty Office and type the whole thing out on oil stencil, old AB Jig machines. Some of you old organizers know what I'm talking about. An AB Jig machine was the best thing we had, the closest thing we had to a computer. We didn't have any computer, duplicated printing and copy machines. My point is, that's what we had. And I had a space left open at the top on this oil stencil where if and when we decided for the name. So Huey dropped up at my house one day, October 22nd, and I had just received a pamphlet, not a pamphlet, but a staple together from the Lowndes County Freedom Organization, Alabama, Mississippi. And it had a logo of a Black Panther. I said, Huey, I wonder why these people put this panther here, this group down here in Lowndes County. And he said, you know, I think the nature of a panther is that if you push it in a corner, first it will move left and maybe move right to get out of your way. If you keep pushing in that corner, sooner or later it's going to come out of that corner. I said, that's just like Black people. We've got to come out of this damn corner. He said, what are you saying? I said, I'm saying we got to name our organization. I said, Martin Luther King and the brothers went out there for peaceful protests. And I said, they jumped on them, beat them, shot them, and killed them. I said, we tried to get a street light at the corner down here. I said, and the city government is ignoring us. You know, I said, they keep pushing us in the corner. And so I said, well, let's name this organization, Huey. He says, well, what are you going to call it, the Black Panther Party? I said, what about self-defense? I said, we've been talking about self-defense. He said, what about the Black Panther Party of self-defense? I said, okay, fine, Black Panther Party of self-defense. I said, I'm going to go down there. And I said, I'm going to put the name and title of our new organization. So I went down to the Warren Poverty Office, did that. My director came in, what is this here? I said, it's like Warren Poverty. This is a Warren Poverty Office, Black. Anyway, after everybody was off work, I told Huey to come down and we finished stapling up a lot of copies. And I said, Huey, I said, we started this new organization. Huey said, well, we need a couple of officers. I said, what are we going to have? I said, we're a political party. We stand for the right to self-defense. He said, well, we're probably going to need a minister of defense. I said, okay, minister of defense. I said, so we need a political party. We need a chairman. He said, what you want to be? I said, what you want to be? I don't know what you want to be. So I took a silver dollar. I said, I'll flip it for chairman. I flipped the silver dollar into the land. I said, heads, I'm chairman. The land on heads. I said, I'm chairman. I got ready to hand in the silver dollar. I said, no, you mean? He said, what do you mean? I have a right to flip the coin. I said, no, you don't. What do you mean? I says, I'm chairman. There's only two officers. You automatically minister to the parents. Whatever is the way you eat, you can't minister to the parents. So I says, now remember, I made one agreement with you. I don't never want none of that infighting like Malcolm and Elijah Muhammad and other people. You and I shake hands now. We always run this organization together. We shook hands on that. So we decided we would, the first thing to do to capture the imagination of the people is go out and observe the police. I mean, Huey's 2 years in law school at this time. Huey has researched all the laws on guns. Not only that, he's researched all kind of other constitutional law. You know what I mean? California State Supreme Court rulings and stuff like that just pulled out. He said, there's a California State Supreme Court ruling that allows people to observe police. So it was the law that he was really in the context of. A lot of people think the Black Panther Party was about just brandishing weapons just because we had some guns. But we were college students. We were my father. You know what I mean? I mean, my daddy and his buddies raised me not only as a carpenter and a builder, but I was raised a hunter and a fisherman. My father bought me my first 30-30 Winchester high-powered rifle for hunting deer and bear when I was 12 years of age. These guys taught me how to shoot that 30-30 Winchester with 3 shots and shoot it correct. These are old, really Black ranchers from down in Texas, the Goodman brothers and the Wilcox brothers and some others who are Bud Daddy's friend. They were all from Texas. But the kind of men that I was raised around Well, really, man, didn't take too much crap. I see my father shoot a man's arm off, trying to kill him when the man had already tried to kill my father. With his 300 Savage high-power rifle, hollow-tip ammo, boom. I was 13 years of age. My father taught me literally. My father was not a man to go around fighting people. My father had businesses in the community. The Seals and Sons and the furniture repair shop. He hired 5, 6, 7 people in his business periodically up and down. But that's the context by which guns were to me a tool. My people from East Texas, Jasper, Texas, the Trailer Settlement. My mother, it was 16 children in our family. My mother's the last one living. She's 95 years of age right now. My point is that that was this history of this humanity surrounding me and influencing me. You know, when we come down to what the guns were about, people think the guns were about some machoism. It was not. We were avid readers. We were researchers. I didn't allow religion to take secondary position in our organization. I said that. Didn't mean I didn't work with religious groups. Any progressive religious group we worked with, once we started our Free Breakfast Children program, whether it was Episcopal, whether it was Unitarian, we found a Catholic in the black community in San Francisco, Father Boyle, he says, you can start a breakfast program here. Right in that, because we had these breakfasts. This is the kind of stuff we were about. But we went out to control police as a means to capture the imagination of the people so we could better organize it. Everybody didn't have to carry a gun. And it took us 2 months up until the first week of January to get 14 members. I mean, I put an office up and everything, took my paycheck and brought it, and I paid to sign up. But my point is that we were going to patrol the police as a means to capture the imagination of the black community so we could better organize them into a political electoral unity. We wanted to use the political electoral process too. So we went out. I mean, we trained these party members. They had to know the 10-point platform and program. They had to come to political education sessions. If you go to my website, you see the first 6 members of the Black Panther Party, November 1966. Only 2 of the people in that picture had military training. That was myself and big man Elbert Howell. So we were the ones who taught everybody else, including Huey, how to use these weapons. You know, people writing books that Huey knew, taught Bobby Seale everything he ever knew about weapons because they don't like me. What are you talking about? Huey knew he was 6 years younger than me. I mean, when I was 12 years old, I was taught how to shoot a high-powered rifle, a 30 to the wind. He was 6 years late. No way in hell he was 15. When I was in the United States military, I was a marksman or expert shot with an M1 carbine, and he was 12 years late. So my point is, we went out there. We taught everybody. They had to know the law, all the little law points that Huey talked about. He was very, very good with these law points. How only one person talks. When the police say something, let the police first say something, because under the law, if you first say something, the California Supreme Court rulings that he had studied, then it's not interfering with a police officer for you to answer that police officer back, etc. So imagine us, and one female who finally joined, coming out one night, down in West Oak in the red light district in black community of Oakland, California. Some police had stopped some young man and standing at the back. When we walked up, the young man had his head in the back of the trunk of the car, the police vehicle. The passenger door was open and the police was sitting inside on the passenger side writing something. Black folks on the corner here, some walking by, some coming out. 10 or 20 of them may be watching this arrest, but not really paying that much attention to it. Until we walked up, nighttime, half of us have long guns, half of us have pistols. I carried an Army 45 holster pistol. We knew the law. Long as a gun from weapons were not concealed, was not considered illegal. Long as you were riding in a car, you couldn't have a live round in the chamber of a rifle or a shotgun under California law. You couldn't load it until you got out of the car. It did not apply to a handgun, and so on. We knew all this even before we hit the streets patrol. We're trying to take away the mythical misrepresentation that the Black Panthers were a bunch of macho dudes with some guns. That's not what real, true human liberation struggles are about. Posturing with guns just for the sake of posturing with guns. We were there for a certain tactic and method to organize people, beginning with capturing their imagination. So as we walked up, somebody started, says, "What they got in their hands? Sticks or something?" Hugh says, "No, everyone, we're here, the Black Panther Party," and Hugh is pointing back towards the police officer. And the police officer is getting out of the car, I'm watching him. And they've been brutalizing our people in the community, so everyone stay here, you have a right to observe these police officers who've been brutalizing us. And as Hugh turns around, the cop, "You have no right to observe." And Hugh says, "No, no, no." And Hugh quotes some, you know, those law books, you know, the knowledge, the rulings, and sunset code, blah, 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 California State Supreme Court, rule states that every citizen has the right to stand and observe police officers carrying out their duty, only stand a reason just as well. Reason just that particular rule was constituted 8 to 10 feet. I'm standing approximately 20 feet from you.
Snatches the door open.
And I see Huey, this cop trying to get killed. And he reaches in across Huey, because Huey is driving the car. Actually, the way this happened is Huey, Huey was meticulous about the law. Huey would rage and crack his window by 3 inches and stick his license to the car. He said, most people, he says, Huey was always trying to test the law. I remember the cop put his flashlight on, flashed his red light. I says, Huey, you can stop, you already flashed his light. He says, no, I could be colorblind. I'm on the way to put the siren on. Snatched them, reaches over, I'm holding Huey's shotgun, I'm pulling back, pulling this Army 45 out. Huey hits it, but little Bobby is coming over the seat with the butt of an M1 carbine. Boom, it hits this cop. Huey pushes this cop out. I come out this door in the front. Huey grabs his shotgun, little Bobby comes around the back. We got this cop surrounded by the time he gets his bounce, you know what I mean? And he wants to go for his gun. Huey said, go for it, I'll blow your racist brains out where you stand. I'm walking around with this part, but I said, yeah, you bring your ass up here for cat ass. I said, no, but you quick, you have to think you're going to brutalize us. I said, but we will kill your racist ass sitting up here. And the black folks is coming out of the door.